This massive two-part episode was written by John Livingstone. He's a master's graduate in international relations, specializing in the Troubles, and he has been researching this topic heavily for the past 7 years. Throughout this podcast, we've covered the Republican paramilitary groups, the official IRA, the provisional IRA, and also the INLA, focusing on what they were and what they stood for. When it comes to the Loyalist paramilitary groups, the two main ones were the Ulster Defence Association, aka the UDA, and the Ulster Volunteer Force, aka the UVF. So who were these two paramilitary groups, and what exactly did they stand for? In this two-part episode, we'll be breaking down Loyalist paramilitaries with a focus specifically on the UVF and the UDA. I know there are many more, but they will get their own episodes eventually. In this episode, we're going to look at the UVF and the UVA, and how they both began, what their differences were, how they ran their operations, when did they work together, and why did they start killing each other. Just a heads up, this episode is quite dense, and I will be saying UVF and UDA quite a lot. And it's probably an episode I wouldn't recommend to new listeners of the podcast because of the dense nature of this material. So let's get into it. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast about the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Ever since the period of violence known as the Troubles ended, many of the Loyalist Protestant community claim that there is little care for their cause and what they stood for. One Loyalist research page claimed that the media treated Loyalist paramilitary groups as if they were just one big featureless group, that they all looked alike, they acted alike, and wanted the same thing. But this isn't necessarily true, and least of all when it comes to the UDA and the UVF. Both paramilitary groups had a distinct way of functioning, and they were governed by different rules and regulations. The Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF as they are locally and universally known, were a Loyalist paramilitary group responsible for over 500 deaths throughout the Troubles, with two-thirds of them being Catholic civilians. The UVF were behind some of the most sinister and notorious killings of the Troubles, including the Miami Showband Massacre, the McGurk's Bar attack, the infamous Shankill Butchers, and the Dublin Monaghan bombings. The group came to existence in 1966 in Northern Ireland, taking its name from its forebearers, the Ulster Volunteers, which formed in 1912 and were covered in the Edward Carson episode earlier this season. The earlier Ulster Volunteers formed to repel and fight Home Rule and the rising tide of Irish republicanism, which was growing by the day in the Republic and would culminate with the Easter Rising of 1916. The more modern UVF, however, was an amalgamation of working-class Protestants headed by their leader, Gusty Spence, who was also covered a few episodes back. Its primary aim was to combat Irish nationalism and forceful republicanism. They did this by issuing a threat of immediate death to any members of the IRA that they came upon. In addition to this, the UVF that began in 1965 claimed that its sole purpose was to protect the Protestant community and maintain Ulster's place within the United Kingdom. On May the 21st, 1965, they gave this chilling statement so that nobody was under any illusion what the organisation was about. Quote, "From this day, we declare war against the Irish Republican Army and its splinter groups. Known IRA men will be executed mercilessly and without hesitation. Less extreme measures will be taken against anyone sheltering or helping them, but if they persist in giving them aid, then more extreme methods will be adopted. We solemnly warn the authorities to make no more speeches of appeasement. We are heavily armed Protestants dedicated to this cause." Though they did claim initially that they only planned on killing Republican combatants, unfortunately, it wasn't always the case where the UVF would just kill Republican paramilitaries. And in fact, many, many civilians would die at the hands of the UVF, just like many civilians died at the hands of Republican paramilitaries. The more modern UVF was being formed in response to changes that were being considered by the then Prime Minister Terence O'Neill, which was in Loyalists' eyes appeasing the Irish nationalist community. It is well known that Loyalist organisations did not like to take credit for their actions, and would often use the guise of other organisations or pseudonyms such as the PAF, which is Protestant Action Force, or Red Hand Defenders. This was done to throw the scent of security forces off their tail. However, as we'll be told later, this was not entirely successful. The main areas of operation for the UVF was the Shankill, East Antrim, Portadown, and part of Armagh. The UVF also had what many have called a satellite paramilitary, called the Red Hand Commandos, which was considered a lethal arm of the UVF. It must be stressed at this point, the Red Hand Commandos were an independent arm of the UVF that had their own command structure and internal organisation. Yet they were in constant lockstep with the UVF. On October 2nd, 1975, the UVF carried out several attacks consisting of bombings and shootings across Northern Ireland, which left 12 people dead. Immediately after this, the UVF was outlawed by Merlin Rees. Later that week, Ulster's security forces, alongside the British Army, swooped down on the Shankill and conducted hundreds of arrests of Loyalist men. This inflamed the Loyalist community and would entrench their mindset of being either betrayed or under siege, and would lead to slogans that would be painted on the side of houses throughout Belfast, saying their only crime was loyalty. At its highest peak, the UVF claimed to have over 1,500 men in their ranks, and a smaller number that were used for combat operations. Remember this number, it's significant when you learn about the numbers in the UDA. So how did the UVF operate? The UVF method of waging war was not entirely unlike their rival counterparts, the IRA. They conducted their military operations via assassinations, home invasion executions, kidnappings, and in particular, no-warning bombings. Their weaponry in the early days has been described by some members as lamentable, as they struggled to get a hold of the advanced weaponry that some of the IRA had at their disposal. It should be stated, though, that at this point the UVF stood out for their bombing strategy. In the summer of 1973, the UVF detonated more bombs than the UDA and the IRA combined. As the troubles would progress, the UVF used explosives somewhat less, because they had a shortage of operatives who had this experience. This would prove to be a constant problem for Loyalists throughout the Troubles. Much of their primary arsenal included automatic rifles, Browning pistols, frag grenades, and even 12 RPG rocket launchers with 150 warheads. It cannot be underestimated that this was a powerful and highly motivated organisation that was able to spread an amount of terror across Northern Ireland equal to their counterparts, the IRA. In addition to this, they were also willing to show that they could take the violence across the border to the Republic of Ireland with the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. So where does the UDA come in? Beginning in 1971, this group was an amalgamation of organised defence associations. Essentially, it was composed of working class Protestants who, in their own words, were going to do the job that the government of Stormont and the British Army had failed to do by protecting the Protestant community and taking the war to the IRA, in particular the Provisional IRA, whom this group hated more than any other Republican group. In the early 70s, the UDA's membership exploded, and they were seen in the media patrolling the streets of Belfast in army fatigues with sunglasses, balaclavas, baseball bats, and World War II service pistols. The group would be responsible for over 400 deaths and carried out some of the most infamous killings that took place throughout the entire Troubles. They would host figures such as Charlie Smith, Tommy Heron, Big John McMichael, and Johnny Adair. It wasn't long before membership for the UDA increased dramatically, making it an extremely formidable force, boasting the numbers of nearly 40,000 men within its ranks, compared to the UVF's 1,500. This is a staggering figure. Its motto was Law Before Violence. However, this changed in 1992 when it was outlawed and changed to Who Shall Divide Us? The UDA was also unique from the UVF, as it had several units comprised of women attached to its body. The role of these women, as a function within the UDA, has been fiercely contested. Their activity would consist of providing safe houses for UDA men, rallying the community to help form roadblocks, gathering information, and letting their homes be used as storage to hide Loyalists' weaponry. This was a boasting point for the UDA, to show the world that they were more egalitarian than their rivals, the UVF. This made the UDA unique within Loyalist paramilitaries, as Loyalism as a body has usually been a hyper-masculine movement. The role of women within the UDA would come to an end after the harrowing tale of Anne Ogilby, a Loyalist woman who was tortured and then beaten to death by other Loyalist women in a romper room for her alleged role in an affair with another UDA man. Anne's death would lead to cries of outrage and disgust throughout Northern Ireland, and will get its own episode eventually. In addition to this, the UDA would often expel or bar Protestants that were affluent or upper class, such as barristers, businessmen or MPs. They did this because, in their own words, it would retain the spirit of the working class Protestant. The UDA's campaign against the IRA and the Catholic nationalist community began in 1972. Just like their UVF counterparts, the UDA would use a pseudonym when carrying out attacks. They used the pseudonym the Ulster Freedom Fighters to take credit for their actions. They also proclaimed that they would only desist in their violent measures when the Provisionals would put down their guns. However, the UDA also claimed, in a poorly hidden warning to the British government, that if Westminster thought that they could pull the wool over the Loyalists' eyes and cut a deal with the IRA and get out of Northern Ireland, the UDA would act as the IRA in reverse, with far more success and far more bloodshed. Throughout the Troubles, the British government, through intermediaries, occasionally engaged in secret talks with paramilitaries in order to try and end the feuding. The UDA saw this as an absolute disgrace. It was apparent that Westminster took these threats seriously, as they were constantly reassuring Loyalists that they had no such intention in cutting a deal with the IRA. In 1974, the UDA took to the streets as part of the Ulster's Workers' Council strike. These strikes effectively brought Northern Ireland to a standstill and saw members of the UDA forming roadblocks and manning checkpoints with what was now their trademark style of camo gear, sunglasses and baseball bats. These displays of strength were particularly audacious moves, because the UDA was showing that they were happy to be very visible on the public stage, showing the people of Northern Ireland that they existed and they meant business. This was in stark contrast to the UVF, who found their strength in the shadows, away from the eyes of the IRA who might wish to assassinate leading members, or from the probing investigations of security services, but we'll get to that later. We have to understand that the UDA was not only highly visible, but they were highly active. Whilst they were manning checkpoints on the streets of Belfast of a day, they were conducting assassinations and pipe bombings at night. This was a highly dangerous organisation, not only for their actions, but for their accessibility to the average working class Protestant. The group prided itself on its working class grassroots background, and would take on those who were politically minded and wanted to defend what they believed was the Protestant way of life. This meant that at their peak, their numbers swelled to a staggering 35,000 men. This attitude of taking in anyone who wanted to join was looked upon in scorn by the UVF, who felt that the UDA lacked professionalism and were thuggish. The UVF believed that when it came to paramilitary members, quality must always trump quantity. This sentiment was perfectly encapsulated by former UVF member and Progressive Unionist Party leader David Irvine, who stated, quote, "I'd sooner be a private in the UVF than a commander in the UDA." The arsenal of the UDA consisted of over 200 Kalashnikov AK-47s, Uzis, Heckler & Koch MP5s, and over 200 handguns consisting of revolvers, Beretta 9mm and South African Lugers. To those who are new to the Troubles, things can all start to look the same very quickly. The flags, the balaclavas and the crowds cheering the gunmen on. This can be even more true of Loyalist paramilitaries. At first glance, the UDA and UVF might look identical, with the same enemy and the same goals. But this isn't the case, as we've already covered. There were significant differences between the two groups. The UDA was seen as a mass vigilante group recruiting everyone they could, whereas the UVF were a secretive, self-ascribed counter-terror outfit. The UVF was a far older organisation with its roots going back to 1912, whereas the UDA seemed to explode onto the streets of Northern Ireland overnight. So how did the two view one another? Well, in the beginning, the UVF watched from the sidelines, as the UDA's membership grew rapidly across Northern Ireland. Like the official IRA was concerned about the rise of the provisional IRA, they did watch with caution. And it also has been alleged that they sent UVF men in secret to UDA rallies and UDA meetings to report back to the higher command of the UVF. Their first main difference was recruitment and size. The UDA far outmanned the UVF. And this might have been considered an advantage, but it has also been considered a fatal weakness. Former UDA commander Andy Tyree claimed that because the UDA wasn't choosy at all about who they took into their ranks, many undesirables joined the organisation. Loan sharks, petty criminals, barroom brawlers and the heads of street gangs. This was in stark contrast to the UVF, who were renowned for their selectiveness. Many recruits of the UVF had to have a clean record and, quote, a respectable Protestant upbringing, as well as a sense of political awareness. This led many within the Northern Irish Loyalist communities to regard the UVF as a far more professional outfit. It also led many within the UDA to hate the UVF for being elitist, full of themselves, and more importantly, for looking down their noses at members of the UDA. The UVF's scrutiny and recruitment led some within Northern Ireland to think that the UVF were simply a better class of loyalist, professional and focused. However, when one looks at the UVF and sees that their membership included people such as Lenny Murphy of the Shankill Butchers, this throws claims that they are a serious high-class organisation into disrepute. There has been a silent consensus amongst leading writers of loyalism, such as Henry MacDonald and Ian Woods, that the UVF were far superior in their efforts against the IRA than their much larger UDA counterparts. Some have displayed the belief that the UDA were second rate against the operations of the UVF, who had displayed the ability and the willpower to go into the Republic of Ireland and commit atrocities, as was evident in the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. This claim would be deeply resented by the UDA, as they stress that they were equal if not more effective in fighting the IRA, claiming that they had formidable leaders in their ranks, and they decimated Republicans, such as the shopping list that was written by the former UDA commander Big John McMichael. This shopping list was a list of IRA members and leading Republican politicians and their relatives all to be murdered. The UDA rightly claim that it was this list that really took the fight to the IRSP and the INLA, and the UDA were successful in the fight that they took to them, as was evident in the deaths of INLA Belfast commander Ronnie Bunting and IRSP party member Miriam Daly, both gunned down in their homes by the UDA. However, many critics of the UDA claim that this was not due to the professionalism of them as a paramilitary group, but more so the backhanded help and collusion of British and Northern Irish security services, which is outside of the scope of this episode, but will definitely be covered in future episodes. However, the UVF claimed that while the UDA were committing random sectarian murders, they had also fallen into petty infighting, and they were now fully in the lens of the public eye, with their annual marches and displays of strength. The UVF maintained that they had always had the edge of being secretive. Except for the likes of Gusty Spence and Billy Wright, many of their leadership remained in the shadows, whereas the leadership of the UDA was highly visible. There was definitely a strategic element to the UVF's secrecy, and the reason being, some had learned some hard lessons. If the Provisionals or the INLA didn't know who you were, then the odds of them gunning you down reduced dramatically. Many learned that to be in the public eye or appear on news stations at night means your enemies could put a face to your name, and the results of this could be fatal. This was seen in the deaths of UVF Belfast commander John Bingham, who was shot to death in his home by the Provisionals, as well as UVF's A Company commander William Frenchy Marchant, who was killed in a drive-by by the Provisionals. There were many other members in the public eye who would meet an untimely end, and the writing was on the wall. To be on the cameras really was flirting with death. Let's talk about their political ventures. It has often been portrayed within the British and Republican media and certain academic circles that the Loyalist organisations are purely reactionary, thuggish and with no political nous or orientation. To put it in more crude terms, they just wanted to stick it to the IRA and don't care about the direction of the province as a whole. It would be a lie to say that the UVF and UDA didn't engage in politics, The UVF and UDA have a proven history of being involved in Northern Ireland's political scene. This was most evident with the UDA, as in the 70s they were significantly more devolved than the UVF. Because of its size and numbers, there was greater room for autonomy. So this meant that the UDA could be involved in anything from community work, vigilante street patrols, to being involved in the local trade union disputes, and all the way up to conducting combat operations. Members of the UDA were also willing to stand politically representing their values, and three commanders also stood as candidates for election in 1973. This was an approach that the UVF were not as interested in. They kept a cool distance from such highly visible democratic processes, and they felt that this distracted from their mission of fighting and executing IRA members whenever they might find them. Gusty Spence made this abundantly clear in his notorious interview in 1972, where he stated that the UVF was a militant force, and only a militant force, and that they had no allegiance to any political party. In other words, they had a job to do, and putting on suits and going door to door trying to get votes was not it. There was one issue that would galvanise the UVF and UDA into the political arena, and also bring them ideologically in opposition, and this was the issue of an independent Ulster. This meant that Northern Ireland would be its own independent entity, free from subservience to Britain and completely detached in all manners from the Republic of Ireland. Essentially, some were calling for Ulster to go it alone. To put it simply, the UDA had endorsed the idea of an independent Northern Ireland. Members of the UDA formed a research group called the New Ulster Political Research Group that would enable them to imagine and vocalise a clear blueprint for the future of Northern Ireland. They believed that if the UDA couldn't vocalise what they stood for, and only for what they stood against, then they were doomed. After a year of meeting, research, debates and consultation, in November 1978 a paper was produced. The paper was called Beyond the Religious Divide, and this would be considered the only tangible policy that was ever greenlighted at all levels of the UDA. This paper essentially called for an independent Ulster that would be self-sufficient and never depend on Westminster's generosity and the sterling pound. The paper was surprisingly well received from all areas of Northern Irish life, even from Paddy Devlin, who was an MP in John Hume's SDLP. Yet, as radical and well-researched Beyond the Religious Divide was, some believed it was redundant, and paying it attention was simply watering a dead plant. Many leading academics believed that the idea of a Northern Ireland that was completely independent of the Republic of Ireland and the rest of Great Britain was a simple child's fantasy. They highlighted the catastrophic impact this would have on Ulster's economy. Many feared a research paper like this containing such a proposal would have delighted Westminster's ruling members of the Conservative Party, who saw Ulster as nothing but a drain on England's coffers, which gave little in return. But this proposal was met with absolute rage and fury by the UVF, and members of the UVF who were incarcerated in the Longkesh prison were particularly incensed about this, whilst they were in prison suffering for crimes of loyalty. Gusty Spence let it be known that he had absolutely no interest in an independent Ulster. His logic was that if they are fighting for an independent Ulster, then what is the reason for loyalism? They were loyal to the United Kingdom under the rule of the British government and Her Majesty the Queen. If they have an independent Ulster, then all their struggles are for naught. How are they loyalists if they're loyal only to themselves? How could they say on one hand that they were as British as the people of London, and then on the other say that they were completely independent and wanted nothing to do with the Republic or the UK? Many UVF members were former British Army members, and the proposition, in their eyes, was a spit in the face of the British troops who had made the ultimate sacrifice for Ulster. And yet, in a far less flowery and poetic way of putting it, the UVF bluntly said that Ulster was already on its knees. Enough men were on unemployment and couldn't entertain such daft ideas of independence, which ultimately would lead to full-blown civil war on the island of Ireland, and would dwarf the horror of the Troubles. We've shown a number of examples of how the UDA and the UVF were split in ideological terms, but did the two organisations ever work together in harmony? As fellow loyalists fighting the same enemy? Military cooperation between the two groups, the UDA and the UVF, was actually a very scarce occasion. The reason for this is as the Troubles were raging, both organisations suffered from informants, double agents and people giving information to the opposite sides, to the RUC and even in rare cases the IRA. And as a result of this tense and paranoid climate, joint security operations rarely happened. Another reason for that is just simply how both organisations viewed one another. Like I've already said, the UVF felt that the UDA's take all comers made them a security risk, or a leaking ship. They had no clue who the men were, and there was no way they were going to risk their men, and more importantly their guns, in the hands of what they thought were just doormen and bricklayers. This in turn would make the UDA hate the UVF even more for looking down their nose at them. And yet, despite their rivalry and antagonistic nature, there were some signs of cooperation, such as joint commemorations where the UVF and UDA men would march and fire their rifles, especially on Remembrance Sunday. Another thing that has to be taken into account is that these men weren't living on different sides of the border or peace walls. They lived side by side in the same communities, they worked together, and more often than not they drank in the same pub. So there would have been a level of coexistence, but not exactly cooperation. Possibly the point of peak cooperation between the two groups was in 1991, with the formation of the Combined Loyalist Military Command. This would serve as an umbrella organisation between the UDA and the UVF, so they could act in lockstep together and confirm with one another. Yet even this caused friction, as both groups argued over whose idea it was to form the group. David Irvin said that the CLMC was the idea of the UVF and the UVF alone. But the UDA vehemently denied this and said that it was in fact their soldier, the dangerous Ray Smallwood's idea. He thought up the CLMC when he was serving time in prison for trying to assassinate Bernadette Devlin and her husband. He burst into their home in Coal Island in County Tyrone and shot at them 9 times, wounding them both. Another occasion of cooperation was December 13, 1992. According to multiple sources, the UVF and the UDA launched a joint attack on Crumlin Road Jail, A-Wing, where Republican prisoners were eating. It has been alleged that a black taxi positioned itself outside of the jail, and UVF and UDA men, all under the banner of the CLMC, leapt out of the taxi and fired an RPG, which embedded itself in the prison roof and exploded. No Republican prisoners were injured in this attack. The attack was a retaliation by the CLMC for an attack by the Provisional IRA the previous year, when the Provisionals smuggled a bomb into the jail and had the device planted on the Loyalist wing where it was detonated behind a radiator, killing 2 Loyalist prisoners, one a UDA member and one a UVF member. The December retaliatory attack, although unsuccessful inflicting casualties, highlighted the capabilities of the UVF and the UDA when they acted in tandem with one another. This attack also put a serious dent in the movement to have prisoners desegregated along sectarian lines. The last and possibly most infamous symbol of cooperation between the two paramilitaries is alleged to have been the assassination of Marie Drum that took place in 1976. Marie Drum was a Sinn Féin politician who was loved by nationalists as she was equally loathed by the loyalists. However, she wasn't just a Sinn Féin politician, she was what many would call a firebrand speaker. Some believed she was just as inflammatory and sectarian as Ian Paisley was, with her shouts that people should not shout up the RA, they should join the RA being the IRA. And her most infamous of all was "We will destroy this town, Belfast." This was in regard to IRA prisoners not receiving special status as political prisoners and not criminals. The more she urged people to take up arms, the more loyalists saw her as more than just a Sinn Féin politician with a loudspeaker. This was made glaringly clear when on the 28th of September, while Strum was recovering at Mater Infirmium Hospital, 2 young male doctors in white coats and clipboards walked into her room, and whilst she was in her bed, the 2 doctors pulled out 2 pistols and shot her to death in her bed. The 2 men escaped out the back of the hospital, leapt into a blue car and vanished. The Drum killing highlighted to the Loyalists what the UDA and UVF could achieve when they channeled their resources together. It's fair to point out that the Provisionals took note of this event and evidently taught what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And they did something similar 5 years later. killing Reverend Robert Bradford. Bradford was an MP unionist and fiery Methodist who again, like Drum, stopped speaking out for unionism and started to speak for violence against Catholics. He was shot dead by the IRA in his office, along with caretaker Kenneth Campbell. Back to Marie Drum. It has hotly been contested by some, such as Jim Cusack, that this wasn't a UVF-UDA joint operation, but solely a UVF operation. This claim has been strongly denied by the UDA. To date, the only person who has been convicted for this killing was Samuel Mathers, who was the security guard at the hospital and was a UVF man. And the case of who this operation belongs to is something still being argued to this day. In 1993, the CLMC suffered a PR calamity in the assassination of Sinn Féin councillor Eddie Fullerton. The UDA had launched a secret mission. Three armed men in camo gear went up to Buncrana in County Donegal. They took a sledgehammer to Fullerton's front door at 2 a.m. in the morning and shot him 6 times as he came down the stairs to investigate the noise. This reflected badly on the UVF because 1, it damaged a ceasefire that the UVF were trying to hold, and 2, the UDA acted with complete autonomy and kept the mission to themselves. This event led to the CLMC being deemed a redundant, useless organisation, and it was then dissolved. All that was left was the UDA, the UVF, and their own mutual hatred and mistrust of each other. In this episode, I've explained the difference between the UDA and the UVF, and how for some it was class, for some it was idealism, and there were many, many things that separated the two groups. In the next episode, we're going to talk about aspects of their relationship which would define the peace process and even change the social fabric of some parts of Northern Ireland. It would also leave a trail of devastation in its wake, with bodies of loyalists scattered around the province. The story of their own internal feuding will be told on next week's episode. Thanks, and see you next time. So again, folks, I just want to take this time to thank you all for listening to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast and I hope you're finding it very informative. These episodes take a long time to research, write, and prepare. So if you do want to support the podcast, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. There's a number of different tiers there, and as well as that, I put up a lot of media related to the episodes, including reading lists, and I also release a Troubles Companion video after every episode I release here. If you'd like to support the podcast in a different way, you can also do so at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. There you can buy me a virtual coffee, which is very appreciated. And if you'd like to support the podcast in a non-financial way, please leave a review or simply tell your friends. Each and every recommendation helps. That's it from me. Thanks again for your support.